I'm very pleased to introduce Paulina Sliva, who's giving us a paper on understanding and knowing by testimony. But first, we're going to start with comments by Alison Hills from Oxford.
Thanks very much, and it's a great pleasure to comment on Paulina's great paper. So much recent work on understanding has been concerned with the connection between understanding and knowledge, and especially between understanding why and knowledge why, which is what I'm going to mostly be focusing on. Several philosophers, including Fanfig, Pritchard, and Meek, have argued that understanding why and knowing why are distinct. But Paulina is arguing that we are wrong. She defends reductionism thesis that knowing why is both necessary and sufficient for understanding why. In the first part of these comments, I'm just going to set out her argument, at least the main strands of it, because it's quite detailed, but I won't be able to cover everything. In the second part, I'm going to very briefly address those criticisms. And in the third part, I want to say something a bit more in general in favour of non-reductionism about understanding. Okay, start with Paulina's argument. The paper is divided into two sections. The first focusing on the claim that knowledge is necessary for understanding, which are called a necessity claim. So the arguments in the literature against the necessity claim, so in favour of that part of the non-reductionism, have tended to take the form of a supposed counterexample, where there's a person who has understanding but not knowledge, and there's an example on handwriting. Suppose that your school has been sent a set of extremely inaccurate textbooks which have been handed out to your class. You're the lucky one who's got the one that's accurate. You read in your book that Stalin was responsible for the deaths of millions of people, and you draw the obvious conclusion that he was evil. Do you understand why Stalin was evil? Seems to me the answer is, yeah, you do. You can explain why he is, and your explanation is correct. You can do so in similar cases, so you can explain why Hitler killed millions of people, or was responsible for those deaths, he was also evil, and so on. So you've got the grasp of reasons, characteristic of understanding. You understand why Stalin was evil. Do you know why he was evil? Surely not. This is a familiar case of environmental luck, fake barn type case, where you are lucky to have true beliefs in a way that rules out having knowledge. But if all that's right, Paulina points out, then we should be able to say, quite comfortably, you understand why P, but you don't know why P. But to many people, that sounds really odd. It's infelicitous. Paulina thinks that infelicity is semantic, not just pragmatic. And we can't just say, well, this is an unusual situation, because environmental luck is all around us. So there would be lots of occasions where you could get understanding, but you didn't have knowledge. Nor can opponents of necessity, like me, just ignore this piece of linguistic data, because they take ourselves to be explaining an epistemic concept that's widely grasped, explaining what people mean when they talk about understanding, not introducing a new concept by stipulation, saying this is what we mean by it. So if that's right, then something must have gone wrong on that initial assessment of the textbook case. And there seem to be two possibilities here. One is that you do have understanding, we were right about that, but you also have knowledge, perhaps because you've got a safe belief, even though it was in some sense lucky. So you have both understanding and knowledge. Another possibility is that you don't have either. So you don't know why P, but you don't understand why P either. But perhaps you have some related understanding, like some general moral understanding about the kind of thing that makes people evil. So Paulina gives both of those, doesn't I think settle which one she thinks is right, saying these are two options you can take. Okay, the second part of the paper focuses on the claim that knowledge is sufficient for understanding. That's the sufficiency claim. So arguments about this have tended to focus on testimony, and claiming, amongst other things, that knowledge can be transmitted successfully by testimony. So if I know that P and I tell you and you trust me, you can come to know that P. Relatively straightforwardly. But understanding typically can't. So if I understand why P and I tell you that P, you don't typically gain understanding through that. Why not? Why can't you get understanding through testimony? Well, several people, including me, have suggested that understanding requires a grasp of a proposition and the explanation of its truth, of a kind that knowledge doesn't require, and it's difficult to transmit this grasp through testimony. So that's why it doesn't transmit easily. In response to that, Paulina argues that there may be other differences between the speaker and the hearer in cases where there is some sort of failure of transmission. So one thing that might happen is that the speaker has a lot more propositional knowledge and the listener a lot less in terms of their background knowledge. And she thinks that more knowledge why constitutes better understanding. So in a given sort of example of a testimonial exchange, a bit of knowledge why gets exchanged, but not everything. And so the speaker still has better understanding why than the hearer. So in the case that Duncan Pritchard has talked about, the father understands why the house has burned down, namely because there was some faulty wiring. He tells his son, but the son doesn't gain as much understanding, or doesn't understand as well, because there are lots of pieces of knowledge about faulty wiring and its relationship to houses burning down that doesn't get transmitted. Okay. Now we have an interesting sort of reversal of the first case, because now you know YP, but you don't understand YP. Sounds fine to lots of people. But according to Paulina, this should be problematic, because it shouldn't be possible for you to know YP without understanding YP. This one, this felicity, is pragmatic rather than semantic, I think Paulina would say. So I think, strictly speaking, it's false, that sentence. Perhaps Paulina might say something about that later. But what happens is that we use that, we say you know YP but you don't understand YP, to imply that there are some pieces of knowledge YP that you don't have. Basically. So you might understand a bit YP perhaps, but not as much as you could. Okay. And finally, Paulina ends the paper with three advantages of this reductionism, reducing understanding to knowledge. First, it's parsimonious. There's only one epistemic state rather than two. Secondly, it explains nicely, she thinks, why, when, and how we can and cannot gain understanding from testimony. And finally, it fits with this linguistic data. Okay, I'm going to deal very briefly with Paulina's arguments, and I'm going to take them in reverse order. So we'll start with the sufficiency claim. So I think the idea that you are gaining some knowledge why but not everything through testimony seems exactly right, and does say it captures some of the difficulties in gaining understanding by testimony. But Paulina would need this to explain all of the difficulties, and I can't see any reason for accepting that, and I'll say something later on about what problems I think remain. Nor do I think the pragmatic explanation of what's going on there is always necessarily going to be successful. So she's claiming that if we don't understand YP, there's a sort of answer which is there's always some bits of knowledge YP that we don't yet have. And I can't see any reason for accepting that. Or at least, if there is any reason, it's that you've already accepted reductionism. I don't think it can really work in an argument against non-reductionism. Okay, so that was the sufficiency claim. The necessity claim, I think, is more tricky. So I have a little bit more to say about that. So Pauline's argument for the necessity claim turn on the fact that she understands YP but doesn't know YP is infelicitous. Doesn't sound right at all. She thinks that's basically inconsistent because it's impossible to understand YP without knowing YP. I think it's not obviously inconsistent, but may just be very unusual. And of course that makes non-reductionism with an explanation of why is this an unusual thing to say. And Paulina pointed out that environmental luck isn't unusual, and so it ought to be quite common to have understanding without knowledge. But that might be true without it following that we always or even typically say that we don't have knowledge in these circumstances. And it's quite widely accepted that we're often very liberal in attributing knowledge, including in clear cases like this, especially when the agent has true beliefs. And since understanding YP, on my view anyway, requires true belief as well, it may even be that by starting out by ascribing understanding, we're led to recognise that in this situation the agent has true beliefs. And this makes us more likely to attribute knowledge in this casual, liberal kind of way. Strictly speaking, it would still be true that we didn't have knowledge. What about understanding? So Paulina's other suggestion is perhaps that we don't understand why Stalin is evil in the textbook case. Could we just have general moral understanding without understanding why Stalin is evil? Maybe you could. But it doesn't seem anything what's preventing us from applying this general understanding to this specific case of a person who killed millions of people and drawing a clear conclusion that that person is evil.
nothing, it seems. Or at least nothing unless you think that you need knowledge in order to apply it. So it seems to me very plausible that we both have general moral understanding and also specific moral understanding in this case. Okay, let me just acknowledge that there's much more to say about these, and I don't take myself to an answer to everything about Pauline's points here. But rather than going into more detail on that, I want to say something a bit more in general in favour of non-reductionism. Okay, so I'm going to start off with a linguistic data. So, according to Paulina, if reductionism is true, there's only one fundamental extent state. And in English, that state has two names. It's called knowledge and understanding. It is said so good, they named it twice. Now, this might be a feature of English. It just so happens, it's a coincidence, there are two names for this. But in fact, if you look at a lot of other languages, they also have two names for what looks very much like the knowledge-understanding distinction. And I've got a list of them on your handout, a kind of random list of people I happen to know who speak these languages. But I would say I haven't found any yet that doesn't have this distinction. And I think this is that it's perfectly possible there's only one extant state and everybody decided to name it twice. It's just surprising. Secondly, there are some other linguistic data that is a bit problematic for Paulina's view. She recognised that knowledge Y may be graded for quantity, like you can have more or less of it, perhaps more explanations or more deeper explanations or something like that. But there is, it does seem to be a way that understanding can be qualified that knowledge can't. It's something called a qualification of quality. So, again, on your handout, she understands YP, but doesn't fully understand, or doesn't completely understand, or only barely understands YP. Perfectly okay. She knows YP, but doesn't fully know why, doesn't completely know why, only barely knows why. Not felicitous. And again, this isn't just a feature of English. You find this in other languages, too. So let's just say that linguistic data is not entirely in favour of reductionism. Okay, but the main point, I think, is there a clear alternative epistemic state to knowledge? And does it have a clear function and importance? So I think there is. And to explain this, I'm going to start with a famous metaphor from Plato's Meno, that knowledge is true belief that's tied down in the right way. We've all spent a long time trying to specify what that tie is. But it seems like a lot of people have been assuming that there is only one, or there's only one kind of important one, only one worthwhile one. But on reflection, there doesn't seem to be any reason to think that. It seems perfectly reasonable to think that there's one kind of worthwhile tie, which is something like the belief is a result of dealing with one's evidence responsibly. Another is something like the belief is formed safely or by a reliable method or tracks of truth. So there's something to internalism and something to externalism. They're both picking out a kind of tie that is worthwhile for different sorts of reason, maybe. But leaving that stuff about specifically within knowledge aside, it seems to me that there could be a third kind of tie of a very different kind, which I describe as saying the agent has what I call cognitive command, a set of abilities or something more like intellectual know-how concerning the relationship between the truth and the reasons why it's true. So if you've got cognitive command over P and the reasons why P, you can explain why P is true. So for example, you can explain why Stalin is evil. And you can form beliefs that P on the basis of Q. So if you find out that X killed millions of people, you can draw the conclusion that that person is evil. Why is this kind of cognitive command important? Because these are really useful skills. It's helpful to be able to give explanations of truths in this and similar circumstances and to draw conclusions. It's a way of extending knowledge and true beliefs about the world. I think it's got importance in other ways too, especially in acting for reasons, which I alluded to in a question the other day. I don't have time to go into that now. I'm happy to talk about it later if you want to. So if cognitive command is distinctive understanding, why? We can see why non-reductionism about understanding has to be true. These are two different sorts of tie. You can have one without the other. That is, you can have cognitive command without something like safety or epistemic responsibility, and you can have those things without cognitive command. We can also see why it's difficult, but not necessarily impossible, to transmit understanding by testimony. For exactly the same thing is true of all kinds of know-how. is difficult, but perhaps not impossible, to learn, say, how to ride a bike through testimony. So this argument here hasn't said very much about ordinary usage of knowledge and understanding. And I think there's a very significant question of this tie that I've been talking about fits how we normally talk about knowledge and understanding, so whether it can be called in the characterization of those states. I think it's close enough for reasonable to regard one as a characterization of knowledge and the other as a characterization of understanding, even if it doesn't perfectly fit everyday usage. So to conclude, non-reductionism has a pretty good fit with the linguistic data, probably no worse than reductionism. It's got a plausible account of why understanding is not easily transmissible by testimony, and it can be supported by a compelling theoretical account of the difference between understanding and knowledge.
I'm going to stand up because I prefer to tower. Anyway, thanks so much to Allison for the comments, and to John and Billy for organizing and funding the project, and to John Templeton, and to you all for coming. Anyway, so I'm going to make three points in response to Allison, actually mostly focusing on her positive motivations in favor of non-reductionists. And I'm going to take them in a different order from the one that she presented her points. Okay, so the first thing, I just want to quickly address the gradability point. So Allison suggests that, so that's kind of a common argument against identifying understanding with knowledge, is that understanding is something in degrees and knowledge does not come in degrees. And then, as I point out in the paper, you have to be careful what you take the kind of complement of the knowledge or the understanding to be, and a very natural understanding of knowledge. Knowledge does come, in some sense, in degrees, and comes in different quantities. You can have more or less knowledge about a certain question or, about a certain subject matter. You can know more about YP or less about YP. And then I took Allison's point about gradability to be, well, that still doesn't accommodate, kind of, that's not enough to kind of bridge the gap between understanding and knowledge, because understanding kind of is gradable along two different dimensions. First, it's kind of gradable along the quantity, so you can have more or less understanding, but then there's also the qualitative grading. You can have better or worse understanding, or you can have understand fully or only partly, right? So that doesn't match knowledge because there's just the two different dimensions there, and knowledge only has the quantity dimension, right? Okay, so I guess my question is just, it's not clear to me at all. So I agree that when we use understanding, we can say, I understand better or I understand more fully. It's not clear to me that these things correspond to any kind of two interestingly different dimensions. It seems to me we can use them exactly interchangeably. There's no, when I say, I understand better why lung cancer killed her, or like now I understand more fully why lung cancer killed her. It doesn't seem like there's any significant difference between these two. We can just use them interchangeably. So it does seem like even understanding only kind of varies along one dimension. And it seems plausible to me that that knowledge, the quantity of knowledge, matches that one quite well. Okay, so that's just quickly about gradability. So the second thing I wanted to address is the kind of the theoretical motivations behind having understanding as a distinct kind of cognitive state. And I take it, one thing that I wanted to say from the outset is that here, there's a bit of a burden of proof issue here. But I think the burden of the proof here lies squarely on the non-reductionist, because the non-reductionist is asking us to kind of, as Allison said, to accept kind of the introduction of, like, to make a very significant theoretical commitment that's going to revise in many ways, like, the epistemic framework in which we think about things. And whether or not we should go that route is going to depend on whether the notion of understanding is doing extra theoretical work that knowledge by itself cannot do, right? And I guess I am really skeptical that that's really the case, that we really need to posit this distinct notion of understanding in order to do that work. So let me just point this out by going directly to Alison's suggestion. So Alison suggests, look, understanding is really, does kind of important theoretical work because it involves the ability to give an explanation of the truth and to draw appropriate conclusions from reasons why it's true. And then I think in her other papers she also says it also involves the ability to draw kind of true conclusions in similar circumstances. Okay, so there are two things here. One is kind of the connection of understanding to explanation that she takes to be distinctive to understanding. And the second is kind of the ability to draw similar conclusions in nearby scenarios. Okay, so is it really true that if we just had knowledge as our theoretical vocabulary, or like in our theoretical framework, we couldn't accommodate these abilities, or that we couldn't kind of say that they're really important? Well, it strikes me that that's not the case. So take the second verse, so take the ability to draw similar conclusions to similar and similar circumstances. Well, that is safety, as far as I can see. So, you know, given that we recognize that knowledge requires safety, we already recognize that this is a really important and really important ability. Now, what about the connection to explanation? Well, here, I guess I would kind of like the understanding people to like tie down a little bit more what exactly they take the relationship between understanding and giving explanations to be. So, is it just that in general, when you understand YP, you're able to explain YP? Well, that might be true, but surely this is also true for knowledge YP. You know, if I know YP, then in general, I can explain YP. So it seems like, as far as just kind of a general ability for explanation is concerned, there's nothing distinctive here about understanding that isn't also true for knowledge. But maybe what Alison has in mind is something stronger. So she thinks, well, the link to explanation in the case of understanding is much more kind of robust than in the case of knowledge. In the case of, like, in fact, the ability to be able to explain YP is necessary for understanding YP. But it's not necessary for the case of knowledge. Okay, that might be plausible enough, but it's so that might be enough to kind of maybe separate the two, or to drive a wedge between understanding and knowledge. But in that case, it strikes me as just a very implausible claim about understanding. I mean, just offhand, you know, the math genius who's just a little bit challenged when it comes to verbal skills, it seems they might perfectly well understand why P follows from Q, but they cannot explain why P follows from Q. It seems like, in general, there is a link here, but, you know, but we shouldn't take the link to be kind of one of necessity, or we shouldn't think that kind of the ability to explain is constitutive. And I mean, in some sense, we can think about like the saying, like, you know, you haven't really understood it, or like before you've explained it to someone. I mean, you might take this as a kind of constitutive claim about understanding, or what I think is it's rather kind of a heuristic for whether or not you know whether you've understood something. You know, often we think we understand something, but then it turns out we don't really, and kind of being asked to give an explanation is one of these situations that brings this out. Okay, so that's about, so as far as I can see then, insofar as we want to motivate kind of the introduction of a robust notion of understanding theoretically, I just don't see that there's sufficient motivation there, that there's sufficient theoretical work to be done that knowledge cannot do, for which we need this distinct notion for understanding. Okay, so let just finally, very quickly on the linguistic side. So, and that's about, you know, well, why are there two different expressions, and how does kind of the usage of understanding vary from the usage of knowledge? And here I have just, so this wasn't in the paper, but I kind of would like to try it on people. So I'm just going to put it out there, and then you can tell me whether it makes sense or how to modify it. So here's kind of one, so there's a question, you know, why do we distinguish between knowledge and understanding in so many languages? What is this distinction? And here's just one kind of observation. So one observation is that it's often the case that there are some contexts in which I might say I understand YP. So like, you know, it's fine to say in general, I understand why the Russian Revolution happened, or I understand why, like, lung cancer killed her. But then the context can change so that you're no longer kind of happy making that statement. So if all of a sudden the world expert on, like, Russian history steps into the room, you're going to be cautious about saying, I understand why the Russian Revolution happened. And similarly, if you're, like, you're at the Congress of, like, lung cancer doctors, you might be cautious about attributing to yourself understanding why lung cancer killed her. And kind of, so one thought you might think is that, one thought I had was whether or not, like, knowledge versus understanding and knowledge, so knowledge is necessary and sufficient for understanding, but the standards for when kind of the pragmatic implications of using understanding is that there's at least a certain amount of knowledge, a certain quantity of knowledge about the subject matter that you need to have. So, you know, there's kind of background standards that track quantity that determine whether or not the usage of understanding is appropriate or not, or whether you retreat to the knowledge claim. So that was, I'm not sure that was the best way of putting it, but I hope you kind of get the rough idea. All right, thank you very much.
Please keep your hand up until I make eye contact and a finger again for follow-up. Christina.
Yeah, so what you were just talking about is actually on page 9, I think, of the paper. You do mention that a little bit.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I thought right through that. No. And I think it raises this interesting point that relates to the linguistic data. So I think actually that you granted too much to Allison when you granted that, right, you've got these different words in different languages, because you made it sound as though the meaning of those words had sort of trapped similar, right? And they don't, right? So in Latin and in Greek, for example, like nous is a term that's very technical, right? It's specifically used for the grasp on a priori first principles. And any kind of demonstrative knowledge is what you end up calling abstaine. And the same thing in Latin, right? So scio is specifically reserved usually for knowledge that you've arrived at via demonstration. And so, like, intelligo is going to be, when it's used in certain contexts, a technical word for grasp of a priori first principles. Mm-hmm. And so what's interesting is that it means that things have almost flipped. The way, Allison, that you were talking about it, you wanted to make understanding useful for extending one's knowledges and our true beliefs, and that would have exactly been the role of scientia or abstaining. It wouldn't have been the function of what we, you know, would translate or have translated as understanding. And then also there are just a lot of other words for different kinds of cognitive states in these different languages, too. So just talking about it in terms of knowledge and understanding leaves out, you know, a host of other terms that have gotten thrown around in those languages that don't seem to track a consistent meaning over time. So I was just going to say, I think that you conceded more than you had to there.
Oh, that's
so there's something really interesting. I think the way that you want to distinguish them in terms of raising stakes, like the pragmatics of the two terms today.
Yeah, great. That's like one of my favorite kinds of questions or comments. You're right, and here are some more reasons.
Right.
So more of that, please.
Okay, Brian?
It sort of runs through about the linguistic data. I think this is a friendly suggestion. I was kind of thinking one way to push back on the, you know, why we have two names for these things in every language, if they're just the same thing. I mean, it might be that they're kind of coexistence or whatever when you have like a WH complement, but they're, if you have other complements, they just do different, like, quite different things. So maybe that's why we have two words. So like, maybe you can say like, did you understand what he said? Or does it seem like you, did you know what he said? So especially the kind of non-phrase complements might be that they're cases where, like, saying understanding,
you know, not Chris Thompson is solicitous, but knowing kind of Chris Thompson is not solicitous. So I think this is favorable usage to highlight a reason why you might have two different words, even if they're more expensive, for a certain class of confidence, although,
I guess that's something I would have to think more about whether that's good or bad news.
Right, good and bad just because, well, it's further differences between words.
Yeah.
Like, they don't use, they're not even, I see versus what I'm going to say is that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's bad news if you want to generalize the count, but it's reducible on all the different clauses. I mean, that in that case, it wouldn't be good news, but I'm saying it would be bad news.
Yeah. I'm not going to come up with anything to say to this right now.
John and Paul.
I didn't hear all the data because it was a bit far, but just in connection with the WH, it's good to look at who patterns, so knowing who is good. My understanding who is a lot harder.
Yeah.
And completely understanding who, if you try and use the great ability on understanding who, it crashes much more. So I think it'd be good to understand the interaction of the two. There's something funny going on. But so as it were, the really simple reduction would predict,
that it would. Yeah, it's tricky. So I guess so this is really helpful because I'm not a philosopher of language. So but there are a lot here. There are a few here. So this is great. So I mean, there are a couple more, right? When, for example, is also that. So I know when this happened, but I understand when it happened. That seems a little bit iffy. I know where I left my keys. I understand where I left my keys is kind of a little bit iffy. I mean, I do wonder whether I take it there are two. I mean, it depends on what the claim exactly is that I'm defending, right? I'm not interested in the claim that like the linguistic terms are exactly coextensive. I'm more interested in the claim like about whether or not there are two cognitive states here that are coextensive, that are like importantly theoretically distinct. And so in that respect, like linguistic data, there's some limits, right, that can give us maybe some evidence for whether or not there's additional theoretical work to be done or not.
And just one more little set of data points. There are some verbs that are like understanding and taking the gradables for Y, but aren't like understanding that they permissively interact with other WH complements. So figured out is gradable. I partially figured out Y. I've completely figured out Y.
Uh-huh.
But you can go figured out who, figured out where. So, so there's, by these superficial tests, there's all sorts of cross-cutting. Probably good for you in the end, but I feel it'd be good to look at a bigger stock of verbs, like figured out.
Yeah.
Figured out is gradable just as much as understand in connection with one.
Yeah, that's good. Are there any more terms that come to mind? Figure out.
Completely aware of, partially aware
of.
Yeah,
that's right.
So I feel it'd be good to look at the a larger stock of verbs if we're doing for the linguistics.
Yeah, great. Yeah, this is very helpful. Thank you very much.
Rachel?
Hi. Okay, so you've got this case where you say, I understand why Stalin was evil, but I don't know why Stalin was evil, and you say this sounds like really weird, and I think it does, right? But I'm wondering whether if we have understanding and knowledge of future events, you're going to get the same kind of feelings that there's an infelicity in these sorts of conjunctions. So here's a case. So suppose there's an objective 90% chance that the Tories are going to win the next election. And in Tory HQ at the moment, there are like 10 different election strategies written up, but they haven't decided which one they're going to use yet. And they're going to flip a coin or something to decide which one they're going to choose. So like there's a 10% chance that any given strategy will be the one they adopt, right?
Okay.
So. And let's also suppose that they're equally likely to win regardless of which strategy they choose.
Uh-huh.
So I can know that the Tories are going to win the next election, but I can't know why they're going to win the next election because I can know that they're going to choose like any given strategy, because it's just too objectively unlikely to be the sort of thing I can know. But suppose that in fact they're going to choose the strategy of talking more about the EU than any other party, and I also believe that they're going to choose the strategy of talking more about the EU than any other party, and I also believe that the Tories are going to win the next election because they're going to talk more about the EU than anybody else. Right, okay. So it seems to me like in this situation it seems totally legitimate to say, I don't know why the Tories are going to win the next election, but I understand why the Tories are going to win the next election.
Sorry, so can you just say it again?
Super complicated.
You can say what's the last sentence that is okay?
Or it might not be, but it seems at least more okay than the salad one.
Uh-huh.
So the sentence is, I don't know why the Tories are going to win the next election, but I understand why the Tories are going to win the next election.
Ooh, that sounds bad to me. I mean, but I obviously am biased. Maybe we should do a hand.
Did you want to say something first?
I guess it still sounds bad to me. I don't know. I mean, I would be interested to hear whether it sounds good to other people. Go ahead, Lizzie.
Well, I have a thing. The thing that's connected with it, because Alison was saying that why Hitler was evil.
Uh-huh.
I don't know why he was evil, but I can explain why he was evil. But it would seem to me that there's never quite equivocation on explain there. I can offer something which constitutes a possible explanation of why he's evil. I mean, I do that. I offer explanations. This explanation is in fact the correct one, but that doesn't mean I'm explaining. And so that's just supposed to go. To go against Rachel's thing. It's not. If understand, for example, entails explain. I don't think I can give an explanation unless I know. I can state something which is a possible explanation. It might happen to be a true explanation. It doesn't mean I'm explaining if I don't know the premises I'm offering the explanation. So I kind of disagree with Rachel's intuition about that case. And in line with, I think, the dodginess is kind of, I can explain this if I don't know.
Yeah, I guess, so, okay, this is, and you might, exactly, so that's helpful. And one, perhaps a slightly different way to put a point would be to say, well, insofar as we're like at all tempted to think that there might be something okay there, it's not that you understand, but you can guess why, you know, or you have a likely candidate explanation for why, so that would be along your lines. So this is, insofar as we are, so I actually think it sounds bad, but insofar as we're like, can get ourselves into the mind frame in which we think it might be okay, that would be kind of a debunking explanation for that mind frame.
Lizzie, could you say something about why you think giving an explanation needs knowledge?
Well, I don't think I've got a conclusive argument. I just wanted to just say that, you know, I mean, somebody might state something which is in fact the correct explanation of some fact. It doesn't mean that they are explaining it. That was the point. I just think once you make that distinction, it's not so obvious that somebody who doesn't know, you know, the head of the woodwork can explain why it is evil. They themselves are explaining, as opposed to they're stating something which is in fact a correct explanation.
So I mean, I think there is a bit more required, but I think it's a different kind of thing to knowledge. So I think what's required I'm not sure I even think it's required to give an explanation, but to give an explanation in the sense of understanding why, from my point of view, you have to be able to. You have to have this intellectual know-how I was talking about being able to, you know, say what would be true in slightly different circumstances, to draw conclusions from that sort of explanation and so on. So you have to have all this, what I call cognitive command over it. So just kind of plucking something out of the air and saying maybe that's explanation wouldn't be enough for understanding. But the thing that you need extra for understanding is not the thing you need to know. And what I don't see is why you think it has to be the knowledge side of it rather than something else that says we've got to tie this down.
Wait, sorry, but how does that condition just differ from a safety condition from knowledge for knowledge why?
Well, it seems to me that to have knowledge, you need a good justification for your belief, right? And that's something that relates to how you got your belief, where it came from. cognitive demand and linked to understanding is about the relationship between the propositions that you've grasped and the connection between them. So it's not really to do with how you came by those beliefs, but your ability to kind of draw connections between your own beliefs, your beliefs of P and your beliefs of Q. So to say how one is an explanation of the other, or how you can draw a conclusion from one to the other. So this just seems to be different. They're connected to different sorts of things. So I mean, I might know why P, because John's told me and he's a really good source, and I know if he told me something else, then I would know that too, and so on. But I might have not be able to explain prime or anything like that, because he's just told me this one thing in his explanation. So I wouldn't have understanding why. But it seems like I could perfectly well have knowledge.
I'll put you on the queue, but Leah's next to you.
So this is completely clarificatory about the debate in general. So I'm sort of wondering in these discussions whether there's some kind of underlying assumption about connections between knowledge Y and knowledge that, because there's like a lot of talk about, the requirements of knowledge as like, safety conditions and epistemic luck and so forth. And so, I mean, but all these discussions, I mean, they've been done in service of knowledge that, and it's just not clear to me that if you go to the locution of knowledge why, you get the same intuitions in cases. And so I was just wondering if it's because there's some kind of underlying account that knowledge why is knowledge that something because of something or something like that. I mean,
yeah, so that is kind of one of the things that are slightly, that I also find slightly frustrating about the debate. So I think, because there is a separate debate in the literature about the relationship between knowledge why and knowledge that's kind of independent from the understanding literature, right? So I take it, from my understanding of the understanding literature, most people there seem to accept that if you know that P because of Q, then you thereby know why P. So there is an underlying assumption there that knowledge Y, or that at least there's some kinds of knowledge Y that are reducible to propositional, to just propositional knowledge.
But it doesn't go the other way around. So it's not like, if you know Y, P, then you know that P because of Q or something like that. It doesn't go that way around.
It's not, I think I don't think I've seen anything explicit on that.
I was going to say that I think it probably is that way around, because I think that, I'm not sure if people have been explicit about that, but then, I mean, if they're thinking that if they can show you haven't got knowledge that P because you haven't got, because there's epistemic luck or something, then you don't have knowledge why. Then they're thinking that there's the proposition knowledge is a necessary condition for knowledge why, but not necessarily sufficient. So I think it's got to be that way around.
Yeah. So the debate is kind of, the background is whether understanding is reducible to propositional knowledge or not, right? And then insofar as knowledge why is taken to be insufficient, that is because we have a propositional model.
Can you say that last bit again?
Sorry, the reason, one way of understanding the debate is whether or not understanding is a different state from propositional knowledge. And insofar as that's kind of phrased in terms of does understanding why reduce to knowledge why, and then there are arguments against that, that's because there's a background assumption there that knowledge why is reducible to propositional knowledge.
I shared Ellison's worry about the response to the testimony arguments against the sufficiency, that you're more responding to a case than the sort of general worry, at least that your response wouldn't generalize. So I just want to try to give you another case that I think might be harder than, which is somewhat messy case that you respond to. So assume that a very competent mathematician that I know to be reliable and sincere, all that, whatever condition this you could bring up, tells me that theorem T follows from action set A. So on the ordinary accounts, unless you want to be a bit skeptical about testimonial knowledge, I know that theorem T follows from action set A. But it doesn't seem that I understand that theorem T follows from action set A, and it seems to be an epistemic deficiency rather than a mathematical.
Well, I mean, so I knew that a mathematical case would come up at some point. I mean, I'm a little bit unclear. I think, insofar, there's a little bit of a general issue as to what to do with mathematical knowledge, but I take it part of that problem is because it's not really clear, you know, what even propositional model of like how to understand, kind of what proposition it is that you understand in that case. So could we run the case in terms of physics? So the physicist tells you that E equals mc squared.
Well, I think the math case is harder because we can allow full understanding of the axioms in action set A and the theorem T without an understanding of the proof.
Right.
So I'm not sure we kind of get the same structure in the physics case. But respond to the physics case, let's think about whether it extends.
I mean, so one thing, so the question is, so the strategy for the reductionist is going to try to find something that you don't know in the case where you understand one but you don't understand the other.
Yeah.
Right.
So, but I mean, I take it that the problem in the physics case, it's not really clear that there's de re knowledge of the proposition because you might not understand the complement clause or something like mc squared. But the math case, I think, is hard because we can stipulate that I know enough math to understand the axioms.
Mm-hmm.
I know enough math to understand the theorem,
mm-hmm.
right? And I know enough of what follows me to understand that everything in the complement. So we want to say that I do know that theorem T follows from action set A
mm-hmm.
on the basis of testimony.
Mm-hmm.
But we can also stipulate that I am nowhere near enough.
Mm-hmm.
Even if she laid out the proof for me, I wouldn't get it. Right? I don't understand the proof method, blah, blah, blah. I understand that there is a proof. But, so in that case, it seems a stretch to
mm-hmm.
say that I understand that theorem T follows from action set A, right? Even seems quite trivial to say that now.
Right,
so,
but it seems like you also fail to know there's relevant knowledge about the proof that you don't know, right? So you don't know how, how the first line of the proof follows from the axioms, or you don't know why follows from
that on the proof. That might well be a candidate explanation as to why I don't understand.
Right. But
it's not a candidate explanation as to why I don't know, right? And it doesn't seem that we pragmatically, when we say I don't understand, say that I lack, that's the knowledge I lack. I mean, is that what you think?
Sorry. So the case is supposed to be, I know that the theorem follows, but I don't understand
That it follows.
I don't understand that it follows.
I mean, I think you have problems with the why too because of the gradability stuff we just talked about. Right?
Okay, sorry.
That's a different objection.
But the claim is in that case, it's fine to say I understand that P. I know that P, but I do not understand that P.
That's right.
That sounds not okay to me. And it seems to me that. I don't think there's a way to construct it with that case that's going to be plausible. So
yeah.
I was taking you to describe a case in which I know why or I know that.
It's supposed to be that thing. I think the difference for the WH are different, having to do with credibility. But I thought that thing was actually
that seems just so.
Which one is it you deny? Do you deny that I know that the theorem follows?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
John has a follow-up?
Just a bit on the email stuff about because and why. I mean, it feels even sticking within know, it's easier to get context when know why has demands beyond knowing P because Q, you know. I could know that the universe is expanding because the initial conditions were the way they were.
Mm-hmm.
I do know the universe expanding because the initial conditions were the way they were, but I still don't know why it's it doesn't seem too bad to in the same breath say, but I still don't know why it's expanding rather than contracting. And obviously, that's all nothing to do with understands. I mean, it's fairly effortless, those kind of transitions back and forth.
So. Right, but in that case, that's fine.
It's not bad, but it's good for you.
It's good for me, right? Because
in that case,
we can straightforwardly just infer.
Saying that the little toy model where understanding why is knowing some proposition of the form. Understanding why P is known as the truth of some proposition before P because Q.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't, I mean, that seems not the right model.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I just gave you context in which that model seems wrong.
Right, okay, so that's one, that's, or you might think the kind of pragmatic implications that raise the context or something like that, that raise the amount of things you have to know in order to
is it false in the second context that the universe is expanding because the initial conditions were the way they are? But I mean, that never goes false, that because claim. And
you know it
throughout the context, because claim. So it can't be true that at a context it's sufficient for knowing...
for knowing why.
For knowing why P, that it was at that context...
Right.
As it were, you know, the sum Q such that you know P because Q.
Right, okay. There's one other follow-up?
So I was thinking maybe the mathematical case it might be helpful to think about non-constructive proofs. Since there you don't even have to have a business about not knowing how a proof works, you know that the theorem follows from the axioms, and you know the proof. You can say you can do the proof, but it's pretty common to still say you don't know why it follows from the axioms, since your proof isn't constructive. And in fact, that's one of the big complaints, like intuitionist logic and classical mechanics, is that it precisely is that it gets knowledge without understanding.
Okay, so those are all suggestions. Sorry, those are all suggestions for thinking that actually knowing why is not reducible to understand to knowing that, right? Or doesn't those things? Well, maybe they are, but they don't straightforwardly match up, and then. You might think, okay, understanding why could still go with knowledge why. Understanding that still goes with knowledge that. And then, and that's part of what we need to do then when we can engage in the whole discussion, is that's why we need to be very, very careful about being explicit, you know, which complement we're using and what exactly we're comparing to what.
But there's a reason why I put it in terms of knowledge that, right? Because... you just announced skepticism about testimonial mathematical knowledge. Knowledge that, right? You say?
Well, yeah, but that's right. I mean, but that is, I think, in general, there are limits on what knowledge you can testimonially acquire. Like, testimony, it's not the case that if anyone reliable tells you that P, you thereby come to know that P. If you don't have the concepts that are required in order to, you know, if P states a proposition, you don't have the necessary concepts to kind of...
Well, we assume that you have the concepts required for getting T and X.
I think the case is incoherent. The case is either, like, subtly incoherent or you don't have knowledge in that case.
Okay, Laura?
It was on this same thing.
Okay. Sorry, in the back, I'm not sure you...
Yeah, it's connected, so it's... I do see a problem with the why that we're talking about here, why versus that. Because in reading this sentence, you understand why Stalin was an evil person, but you do not know why he was. The first way I read this was, given the instance that he killed millions of people, this particular fact, this instance, I understand. I don't mean you have to say that or why. Say, I understand Stalin was an evil person. But I do not know why he was an evil person. Okay, so this means something else then. I do not know why, in general, he's framed as an evil person. I know the instance of what he did, you could say that he's evil. So there's a different meaning here. So there's this issue with why. So that's definitely the two shades of difference when you put no and why and understand why, you can have very different meaning. So if I put that, I understand that Stalin was an evil person, but I do not know that he was. Now that sounds strange. So that goes towards your point of view. So this thing with why, though, if that could be avoided because it's not always translatable with that, it will strengthen your position.
So the suggestion is that using knowledge that and why that, know that and understand that, strengthens your position. But when you put understand why and know why, somehow you have different shades of meaning there.
So, but is your thought that it's okay to say I understand why Stalin was evil, but I don't know why Stalin was evil?
Yeah, because you can interpret that as saying, given the fact that I was just told that he killed millions of people, I make this kind of judgment that he's evil, but I don't really know why he did these things. I don't know why he did these things. Also, I don't know why he is evil in general.
Yes, so sometimes, in that case, the understanding, knowing flags the difference in content, right? So it's just like you might say, it's still strange to have it juxtaposed as I understand why, but I don't know why. I mean, usually you would do it the other way around. So you could say, I know why she left him, but I don't fully understand, or I don't understand why. And that implies there's something that I don't know. I don't know the whole story about why she left him. So your case makes me think there's another usage of understanding, and I think it interacts in those cases. That's like sometimes we use understanding in a like slightly defensive way. So, I understand you're angry. so that kind of makes me, the way you framed the example makes me think that might be one thing that's going on. You've just like passionately told me why like Stalin was evil. I understand he was evil. I'm not quite sure I understand. I know all the details why. So I think that's kind of what's going on in that particular context. But that just flags like an additional usage of understanding.
Okay, two follow-ups on this? Yeah, Nicholas.
Just to follow up immediately on this. I think Van Frassen's got quite a bit on this. It's quite important what's in the why clause. So, you can easily say stuff like, I understand why Adam ate the apple.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why Adam ate the apple.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but I think it'll help your case in the end.
Yeah.
But I think you can tie that into that. Because in those cases, there's no ambiguity in understand, hopefully.
Right.
There may not even be an ambiguity in why, strictly speaking. It's just in the explanandum, as it were.
Yeah.
It's changed very subtly, even though the phrase is the same. In one case, we're interested why the apple, as opposed to the pear or something else. In one case, why did he eat the apple as opposed to, I don't know, what else you could do with an apple.
Yeah, no, exactly. Right, yes. So, the reductionist slogan is always going to be differences in understanding or differences in the content of what is known.
Yeah.
Right? And that just points out that, propositions or just sentences are crude tools for pointing out contents. Like, saying that I know he ate the apple, that still doesn't tell you what my space of epistemic possibilities is and which exactly it is that I'm ruling out as opposed to which ones are being ruled in. Right. So I agree. That's kind of part of why we need to be keeping track carefully here about what the complements are and what's in the complement, and between kind of the difference between what the sentence by which we might express your knowledge or your understanding versus the proposition that you actually know or understand.
I was just I was just thinking because at the beginning of your paper you sort of introduced things by saying philosophers of science have been doing this for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they also have done some work on that particular stuff for a while, so there's like a ready-made response, as it were.
Okay, that's really helpful, so I should get that from you.
I can give you that.
Did you want to follow up?
Yeah, so it was just picking up on, so the Sultan used these, so also before there was an example of these sentences that are supposed to be infelicitous, and I just wanted to flag that maybe it's good. So on the handout, you never use first-person cases, but you do in the paper, and a lot of people have used first-person cases. And there might be one worry with the first-person cases, namely that it could tie up to things that has to do with the norms of assertion.
Right.
So, I mean, you might think that if you have a first-person case where I understand why, but I don't know why, then the problem could really tie up with something like a knowledge norm of assertion. So maybe you can't know that you understand why if you don't know why, or something like that. So
yeah,
the two different parts of the sentence don't necessarily... I mean, it doesn't have to be because these two things in the sentence are incompatible. It might be because the first clause of the sentence is incompatible with the correct norm of assertion or something like that.
Right, that's interesting. I mean, I did think a little bit about norms of assertion in the context of that, but ultimately I thought that actually any kind of invocation of norms of assertion would be more helpful to the reductionist case as opposed to the non-reductionist case. And so here's why. So on the non-reductionist picture, in some sense, understanding is less demanding than knowledge. Right? And yet, it seems like if I I'm looking for reliable testimony. I'm going to go to an expert, and I ask, you know, who should I ask? And I'm just interested in knowledge. You know, if I pointed out that this person understands the subject matter, that seems to be enough for me to be in a position to rely on them. Similarly, it seems that, you know, if I have good reason that I understand something, that's enough for me to kind of permissibly assert the relevant thing.
So again, are these cases where you know that you understand the thing, or are they cases where you understand the thing?
I was thinking.
So
just
I mean, if you have like
understand.
A source of testimony and you know that they understand the thing, then you know, I mean, that kind of complicates things again.
Yeah.
With these high order things going.
Yeah, but you might just know that they understand, but you don't know that they know, right? And understanding is supposed to be less demanding, at least in some relevant respects, than knowledge. So it would still seem strange that in that case you get to rely on that person's testimony, even though kind of they fail to.
I don't know. I mean, you might be sort of in a... So, if you're in a case where you know that they understand, but you don't know whether they know, I mean, you seem to, in a sense, have more privileged information about them than they do themselves.
Yeah.
So you get more out of the source than the source can use itself for, kind of.
Yeah. I mean, here's another way in which you might think there's an issue, at least. So, either they're, like, complicated interactions, or... there's going to be, the non-reductionist will have to tell some story about norms of assertions that are going to be more complicated than if we just have knowledge as the kind of one state that is the norm of assertion. So either way, that's like there's a significant kind of theoretical cause. Well, there's like, it's yet another kind of theoretical project that the non-reductionist has to take on.
I think the only thing I really wanted to say was that, I mean, it was just like, if I was you, I'd go not for the first-person cases, because you've
right.
got complications
yeah.
with the knowledge.
Yeah.
You might get complications with the norms of assertion. You can avoid those by
yeah. Way. Right. Okay. But I mean, it is fine. Both cases sound equally bad. So that's so I'm okay in that respect. I think both
cases. Hi. I'm just wondering about. I mean, I'm just thinking about. Cases where we use understanding. Now, just thinking about some other kinds of cases and wondering if one of the common. Because so you've got like direct opposite, so you might have like, you know, she really understands, you know, little Johnny, I feel really safe. Or, you know, he's the only person who really understands, you know. But also you could have it within that, you know, he really understands dark matter theory or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's a different thing, but also just even if we got that, another kind of, you know, I really can't understand. How she could have left her child alone at home, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, other kinds of cases. When you say I can't understand how she could have done that, it's not obvious that getting more true propositions is ever going to, you know, suffice for it. So I don't know if you want to comment on those, this broader range of kind of cases.
Yeah, I mean, two things. One thing, I think there is often the case that when I say I just don't understand how she could have done that. It is kind of this matter of, like, I don't know what was going on in her mind. I don't know how she conceived of the situation such that this seemed like a sensible thing for her to do. I guess there's a question whether that's propositional in the end or not.
Well, that's what that seems to me. It's more of a live issue in that case.
Yeah. I mean, it might be. I would be hoping that there would be, that it could be cashed out ultimately in propositional terms. But I guess, I mean, in some ways, there are two separate questions that are going on here, right? One is about whether understanding maps onto the relevant kind of knowledge, right? And then there's a second question, whether knowledge plus WH complements always reduce to propositional knowledge.
Yeah.
And in some cases, in some sense, you might think, we might think that those questions should be separate. I mean, at the very least, it seems like understand insofar as there are reasons to think that they don't reduce, right, that knowledge Y doesn't reduce to knowledge that. There are independent reasons for thinking that. Bringing in understanding into the picture doesn't add any kind of additional motivations for thinking that such a reduction is not going to succeed.
Mm.
So, and I guess to some extent, I'm much less committed to the claim that knowledge plus WH complements all reduce to knowledge that, then I'm committed to thinking that understanding always maps onto the relevant kind of knowledge, and that there is no kind of distinct kind of thing here that's separate.
I guess one of the things I was thinking, I think it's got much more, it's just like, you might think there's like know-how or knowing how involved in understanding, and so that, I mean, it just seems a missing thing that might be in the picture, that like understanding, you know, some bit of theory might be a lot of having know-how about how you have to move around it, and isn't obvious, well, certainly doesn't look like explicit propositional knowledge. So that, would guess that would tap into how we explain what the knowledge component is.
Right.
It seems that there's more to be explored there.
Right. Yeah, that seems right. I mean, you might think that component is also there in the knowledge.
Yeah, especially if you believe of the reductionism knowledge, how knowledge there, right? Because then the reductionism will go all the way through from knowledge how to understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that seems worrisome.
Yeah, there's a bit of it's a little bit tricky how, I think it's in part because in the understanding literature, people kind of don't, you know, there's this vast literature on knowledge how, knowledge that, relationships, and that's kind of, the understanding literature doesn't really engage that much in that, so I'm trying to like stake out a manageable claim, but I think ultimately like to give the full picture about the relationship would required to engage with that literature too.
Okay, Emil?
So, back to the knowledge why, knowledge that thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I talked to you about this before, but I think one reason why I thought that relationship was kind of important is that in addition to the kind of epistemic luck considerations, there might be considerations that has to do with defeat,
mm-hmm.
where it's like, important whether that relation holds, and I think like at least on certain ways of reducing knowledge Y to knowledge that,
mm-hmm.
You have to deny that those reductions hold, because like I think there are a lot of cases where it looks like you can retain understanding although you get defeaters,
mm-hmm.
but you can't retain knowledge that,
mm-hmm.
and so the reductions are not going to look very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
And so for that reason, you know, that's also why I asked whether there's like certain kinds of claims about the reduction from knowing why to knowing that underlying the non-reductivist views, because, you know,
mm-hmm.
there's certain other things that you can do with knowledge that, including something that has to do with defeat that, you know,
yeah.
doesn't look like it carries over to understanding.
Yeah, I mean, in part that's going to depend on your like larger view of knowledge and propositional knowledge, right? I mean, so if you're, I mean, I think I've gone, in the end, I've ended up, I didn't start out there, but I ended up actually very sympathetic to a lot of Maria Arnio's kind of argument, ended up being convinced by a lot of her arguments about defeat and knowledge. And if that's the kind of view you have, then you're not going to be tempted to say that in those kinds of luck scenarios, knowledge that's defeated, but knowledge why isn't. You're just going to think that there's no defeat happening, and we're going to explain our intuition otherwise.
Okay, Laura?
I was just thinking more about the, you know, knowing why to knowing that, and the problem with saying, well, knowing why is just, you know, knowing why P is just knowing, but here's the reason for P. And I guess this is a friendly suggestion, you could be a reductionist and think that understanding why P equated to some kind of knowledge mm-hmm. and knowledge that, without it being just knowledge that P, mm-hmm. or knowledge that Q is a reason for P. Mm-hmm. I mean, it might involve a kind of cluster, you know, Q and R are reasons for P, and I know that they relate in this way, and I know that the evidential relationships work like this. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, it might just be that understanding, you know, denotes kind of a cluster mm-hmm. of propositional knowledge, including knowledge of how the reasons interact. And, I mean, that to me just feels like kind of a more intuitive picture, and I wondered why, you know, the paper went for a very sort of straightforward knowledge that P, understanding that P equivalent. Mm-hmm. And I guess why not go for the picture on which, well, understanding means some knowledge, but it might be a kind of list of a bunch of kinds of knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, part of that is an issue about, well, I mean, so I think this is a case where we're going to have to be careful about what, we're going to have to keep track about what the object is, right? Yeah. So it seems to me you know that P, you understand that P. There's just kind of a sense, if I know the sun is shining, that then I understand that the sun is shining. I mean, in the cases of why P, so, right, I understand why the sun rose or something like this. I mean, in order to either understand or know that, you're going to have to know a lot of things, right? You're going to have to know what the sun is, what rising is. You're going to have to know what it is for the sun to rise. So I guess I'm not sure that there's any, you know, once you realize that these are all concepts that you have to have, even in order to kind of make sense of the proposition, I just don't see that there's going to be something distinctive about the understanding case as opposed to the understanding why case as opposed to the knowing why case.
Sure. I guess I was thinking, if you wanted to maintain some kind of, well, knowing why reduces, mm-hmm. and maybe you're not wedded to this, knowing why reduces to knowing that, mm-hmm. it needn't reduce to something so simple as knowing that Q is a reason for, mm-hmm. right? So you might think that knowing why is actually a bunch of propositional knowledge about the different relations, or, I'm not sure that you might think that understanding why, mm-hmm. Like knowing why, is actually a fairly rich set of propositional knowledge.
Mm-hmm. So. I think that there's more packed into the P because of Q, knowing that P because of Q. I think in some sense that doesn't kind of pin down your, I think that is actually a fairly rich epistemic state, right?
Right.
Even the simple, straightforward knowing that P because of Q. And just attributing to someone knowing that she knows that P because of Q doesn't in fact kind of uniquely specify her epistemic states. There might be lots of people of which we might say that, and yet they pick out a different, they know different things. They pick out kind of different, more fine-grained or less fine-grained propositions thereby. So I would say any of these is sufficient to get your understanding why, but you'll like, you have better, you understand more fully, or you have better understanding, kind of depending on what content actually the P because of Q picks out for you, right? Does that make sense?
I'm going to move along, I think, because we've got a few more on the queue. Jeff, did you have a hand?
I did.
You did?
Use a hand, yes.
All right, you're next.
There's another.
can take that skeptic.
Sorry. I think it starts to be my question.
Yeah.
So I wanted to just gesture at something else that might be helpful to think about. So if knowledge entails understanding, then any fact of attitude entails understanding.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not totally sure how this breaks, but it's interesting to think about. You know, so I was happy that Christina's hair was pink, but I didn't understand that Christina's hair was pink. I'm not totally sure about that. It doesn't feel the same to me as to know, but it's just something to consider.
All right. I was happy that. I mean, does that express knowledge? Does it entail knowledge?
That's what I was thinking.
I mean, you might think, it entails that, Christina's.
So how about I observed? I observed Christina's hair was pink.
Yeah.
But I didn't understand that Christina's hair was pink.
That one I find more actually dicey. So I think as soon as you actually have seeing that, hearing that, telling that, I think those do entail, so things that are straightforwardly construed in like ways of knowing, then actually denying the understanding claim is more tricky. Like, I see that Christina's hair is pink, but I don't understand that it's pink. I might not understand why it's pink, but...
Oh, I'm going to skip follow-ups because we're almost out of time. I want to get the questions in. John?
Oh, well, if other people have questions, it's
Okay.
Mine is actually very closely related to this. Do you need to say anything to people who don't think that understanding is factive?
I was hoping not.
Okay.
Some people don't think that, but I think that's just crazy.
You can, I mean, I don't think of myself, but you can sort of see why in a certain way, especially when you're thinking about, I don't know, if you think that the scientist's understanding is the model of the rich cognitive state we're talking about, then strictly speaking, some of the propositions that they have a certain attitude towards, you know, they might be really useful at explaining things, but they might not strictly speaking be true, or even non-strictly speaking be true. Is that that's not a worry at all?
So I have a rant. I don't have a response, but a rant about that. I think that's again a case where we have to be really careful about what exactly it is, what the content is that we're attributing to them. I think there's also lots. Okay.
Just on this cognitive command thing, it seemed like worth testing it out by looking at cases where you lack it and seeing how understanding vibrates. So, you know, I know that the piggy bank's full because little Johnny, you know, keeps putting his money there. But I've also got a lot of crackpot beliefs. I think that putting money in piggy banks causes your brain tumors. I think all money is made of gold. I think in good Christian families, piggy banks are full because they're spontaneously generated. You know, like, I mean, I can keep keeping it on like that. And so, you know, and I think false NAD or the false inference that piggy banks are full of gold. I do understand why there's money in Johnny's piggy bank. But, you know, by I'm looking through these standards and it doesn't seem like I have cognitive command. But it seems at least worth testing, you know, taking away cognitive command, you know, building up crackpot beliefs in similar cases. You know, you think, wow, that Christians, that's a totally different kind of big, you know, story for those people. I don't get a sense that I now don't understand why there's money in Johnny's piggy bank.
Yeah, I think I slightly lost track of all the crackpot beliefs you have there. But I think in the way that Pauline was talking about, I think exactly where they stand in relation to the things you think you understand is really important. So if what you if you understand why the B bank is full because Johnny's been putting money in it, right? If if your grasp of those two things is perfectly good, so you know that like if you took, you're aware that if you took some out, then it wouldn't be full anymore, and if you put some back in, then it would get, you know, all that kind of thing, then that might be just enough to understand why it's now full. There'll be lots of other things that you didn't understand that are connected to it. So I think with a kind of close enough specification of what you've understood, you might still be okay. In a broader sense, you might have gone badly wrong, but then, I mean, if you said you, I don't think what else you might think you might want to understand that you didn't know.
I mean, it's just you said, give an explanation of truth in this and related cases, and in this case that I just described, you don't get it right in related cases.
So in related cases where somebody else puts money and you don't know it's full, you don't draw that conclusion?
No, in related cases where the piggy bank's full, you don't think it's because of the money, you think it's, and I gave crackpot. You give completely crackpot explanations in similar cases. Because you think falsely, but say, oh, if there's a red door on the house, it's a totally different.
Okay, if it was something that related to that, then yeah, I'd be inclined to say you didn't really understand anymore. So I mean, if I asked you why, and you said, well, he's put money in, and I said, so what if I did that? And you said, well, it would be different for you. That wouldn't make it for you. Yeah,
I understand what I'm saying, but you, I think, you know, suppose I think that piggy banks, kill people with long hair. I think if you went anywhere near this, you'd just drop dead.
Yeah,
you're saying I don't understand why Johnny's piggy bank is full, because I think it would kill you if you went near it.
Yeah, so I think you think one of the components of the explanation is that he'd had short hair, and that's not true. So,
no,
yeah,
just why, yeah.
So I think, yeah, I think when it's...
So you don't...
I mean, so if I said to you, why is it that his is full but mine couldn't be? And you said, well, he's got short hair. That's not part of the explanation. You think it is. You think it's an essential part, in fact. So, yeah, you've got it wrong. You don't understand. I mean, I think we attribute... If we've got inclined to attribute understanding, because we've narrowed down what we're thinking about. But if you're going to tell me that the full explanation includes that he's got short hair, then no, you don't understand.
So if I thought that were he a certain sort of person, think it would spontaneously generate, then I don't understand in this case why his piggy bank's full.
Probably not. Yeah, I guess I might want to hear a little bit more about it.
Just my judgment about the case, I find it hard to... I think I understand how the view goes.
Okay. I mean, it's tricky though, because you want a modal condition and you want it to be not just safety, right? Because in some cases, in the cases where you start pushing, you might, once it starts to infringe on safety, we're like inclined to withhold the understanding judgment. But you need a story that's not going to appeal to safety, that's going to appeal to something else.
So I think you can have a bunch of safe beliefs that fall short of cognitive demands. That's how I would. And you can have cognitive command without safety as well.
Yeah. So you need, but you need then a modal condition for cognitive command that's going to be in some ways more and in some ways less demanding than safety. And I take John was pressing is that's a substantive thing to kind of that's a substantive
test.
Yeah, that's a test.
Yeah.
All right. Well, please join me in thanking our speaker.